Today's newsmaker is Matt Desmond. He's a Ford Foundation Fellow, and he's a UW-Madison sociologist. He's also a good friend. But he has just done what has been called a landmark study on evictions. And he did it on evictions more specifically in the city of Milwaukee. Matt, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it has been called a landmark study. So let's talk first about some of what you found. Can I just read a couple statements and then you expound on them?
Please.
Women living in black neighborhoods, but not those in white neighborhoods, are evicted through the court system at higher rates than men. Number one, women from segregated black communities at especially high risk of eviction. Eviction has become typical in the lives of women from these neighborhoods. Major findings, Matt. How did you come about them?
Sure. So this particular piece or arm of the study is a simple analysis of court records. It's not simple when you get into the details, but
because you looked at how many court records?
There was about there are about 900. Or excuse me, 90,000.
Over what period?
Over 5 years.
Okay.
So there's a lot. It's a lot of data, and national data on eviction don't exist. National data on foreclosures do, so we don't have an idea of how common eviction is in the national scope. In Milwaukee, it's more common than we think. So citywide, it's about 1 in 25 renter-occupied households are evicted annually. One in 25 every year.
Okay.
If you zoom in on just predominantly black neighborhoods, that ratio jumps to 1 in 14. So it's quite common in the city, and it's very common in low-income black neighborhoods. Now the question is, who is getting evicted in these neighborhoods? And if you look at the court records, you see, like you pointed out, a significant disparity between. So in the court records, there are about 1 in 30 men from predominantly black neighborhoods are evicted every year. But that ratio is 1 in 16 for women from those same neighborhoods. So women are more than twice as likely to be evicted through the court system than men from the exact same neighborhoods.
What is some of your findings? What do they mean for us as a society? Or you just looked at Milwaukee. Is it unfair to ask you to stereotype about America based on one study's findings, Matt?
I mean, the jury is still out about how generalizable these findings are to other municipalities. But we have reason to believe they probably aren't that different in other cities that are like Milwaukee. So with respect to racial segregation, level of poverty, and cost of rent, Milwaukee is a lot like Cleveland and Indianapolis and St. Louis and other Rust Belt cities. It is quite different than cities like San Francisco, New York, Boston. What's different about these kind of more, these larger cities or coastal cities is that the majority of renters are not poor in these cities. There's a mix between high-income and low-income renters. And in those cities, you tend to have more toothier tenant unions and traditions of tenant unions and organizing, especially in New York and San Francisco. But in most other cities, especially Rust Belt cities, that tradition is atrophied in cities, especially where the majority of renters are low-income families.
So what do we have here, the emergence of a separate and unequal system in terms of who loses their housing?
We have a parallelism within the black community with respect to the incarceration crisis for men.
Okay.
And so we have in the last 30 years two processes that have emerged that have become commonplaces in the lives of low-income African-American folks. Incarceration has become typical for black men. Eviction has become rather typical for black women. And so you have these two processes, this kind of marriage of hardship, so to speak, that work together to kind of breed and reproduce urban poverty in the city cores.
Yours has been called a landmark study. There had been no study on this subject before? No?
Not really. I mean, it's a legitimate oversight on the part of poverty researchers. There's reasons for that. One is housing has moved off our agenda in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Housing is a financial issue, gets a lot of attention. Housing is a social issue, aside from a lot of studies on racial segregation, is largely off poverty researchers' desk. We're focusing a lot on welfare, we focus a lot on the family structure,
yeah.
Education, things like this. But housing seems to have seems to have been, I don't want to say overlooked, but not got enough attention. And if housing hasn't got enough attention, eviction has been virtually ignored. One of the reasons for this is just how hard it is for the data to come by.
Right.
So there's been a handful of studies here and there, but in terms of a serious kind of sustained study of eviction, we haven't had one.
How did you come upon the subject of eviction?
I thought if you looked at eviction, you could learn new things about urban poverty. For example, you could learn how people in a really sticky mess rely on their friends and families. Do they call mom and dad when they get evicted? Do they not? Do they rely on so-called weak ties with just acquaintances?
I'm sorry, what ties?
Weak ties.
Weak ties, okay.
Yeah. Or do they rely
on... You're a sociologist.
I know. or do they rely on more strong ones, so to speak, with family members? What can you learn about how the low-income housing market works through eviction? So I thought eviction was a prism through which new things about not only housing but urban poverty in general could be elucidated.
Which of these findings most surprised you as a sociologist?
The magnitude of it.
The numbers, the
yeah,
2-to-1 ratio, or the actual number
the
of
actual
evictions?
The actual number of evictions. You know, I mean, I think we had good reason to suspect that there would be a gender discrepancy. I didn't think that discrepancy would be as acute as it actually is. But I hadn't, I mean... To think that, you know, 1 in 20, citywide, you know, not controlling for poverty at all, 1 in 25 renter-occupied households in the city of Milwaukee every year are evicted. That's surprising, and I should state that these are really conservative numbers. The reason for that is there's a lot of evictions that occur beyond the purview of the court, so-called informal evictions. So these can happen from anything from illegal strong-arm evictions where a landlord hires kind of a group of thugs to take care of it or change the locks on you, to more kind of benevolent ways when a landlord comes up to a tenant and says, look, you're behind, I know you're not going to get caught up, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $200 and let you use my van if you're out by Sunday. Those evictions take place all the time. In fact, one landlord told me for every eviction that I do that goes to the courts, there are at least 10 that don't.
10-to-1 ratio?
But this is one person. I mean, we don't know exactly what the ratio of formal to informal is, but we do have reason to suspect that informal evictions constitute a non-negligible percentage of forced moves.
How did you pick the city of Milwaukee? Because you mentioned Cleveland and other other Rust Belt cities.
Right.
Why Milwaukee?
Well, Milwaukee, it's one of these cities that is central to the American story that has largely been overlooked in accounts of urban sociology and poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so New York, Boston, San Francisco, places with major research institutions get a lot of play in this kind of, in our ideas and our theories of poverty, Chicago especially.
Okay.
Milwaukee and places like Milwaukee haven't. So I wanted to put a city like Milwaukee in the story. And I also chose Milwaukee because it's a fairly poor city. It has extremely high levels of poverty and it's a very racially segregated city.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see how housing intersected with those larger problems.
Okay, so you identified your subject, evictions. You identified your city. Now, how did you adopt your methodology?
Sure. Well, there's three methods. One is the one I already talked about, the analysis of court records. But that wasn't the first method I used. The first method was just the old anthropological way of picking up your bags and moving and dropping yourself as completely as possible into the lives of people that you wish to understand. So I moved to Milwaukee. I rented a trailer in a low-income trailer park on the south side of the city and got to know, it was a majority white trailer park, and I got to know families going through an eviction there.
Mm-hmm.
And then after living there for about 4 months, I picked up my bags and I moved north to the black ghetto, and I rented a room in a rooming house. And I lived there for about 8 months, a little over 8 months, and got to know families going through an eviction in that side of the city. And I followed them throughout the eviction process. I knew a lot before they got the notice. I went to eviction court with them. I helped them move. I followed them beyond Milwaukee if necessary. I went to Iowa. I went to Texas if the families moved there after the eviction. And at the same time, I also kind of embedded myself in the lives of the landlords doing the evicting. I wanted to study the entire kind of set of relations that is eviction. So I spent a lot of time with landlords. I helped them hand an eviction notice. I went to court with them too. I saw them play blackjack with collected rents. I saw them exploit tenants, saw them get exploited by tenants, and kind of spent a lot of time with everyone in between, court commissioners, social workers, family and friends of evicted tenants, and kind of got a real up-close and personal with the process.
Matt, this fascinates me. How did you pick these two neighborhoods? First of all, let's talk about your trailer park.
Sure.
There's a lot of trailer parks you could have picked. How did you pick this one?
This was the most notorious of Milwaukee's trailer parks. It was going through...
In terms of what?
In terms of...
Housing issues or crime or
in terms
police
of,
calls?
In
or?
Terms of crime, police calls, and kind of... And property violations, yeah, housing conditions, yeah. So the trailer park I rented, for example, didn't have any hot water for the whole time I stayed there.
So you rented a small trailer for, what'd you say, 4 months?
Yep, that's
how
right.
How much were you paying?
$550.
$550?
Yeah.
And just you in a trailer park?
Just me in a trailer, the trailer park, right.
Your spouse didn't join you at all?
No, we did long distance for the year.
Yeah. Okay. So you picked this because it was, you thought, Milwaukee's worst trailer park?
Yeah, it's...
And it... It was.
Well, I can't say, but there were high levels of poverty in the trailer park. There were a lot of eviction. There were a lot of housing issues, and there was a lot of drugs. And so, what I wanted to do with respect to the trailer park and the rooming house on the north side was to understand if. To compare white poverty and black poverty with respect to these questions of eviction. Are the experiences of a white family who is evicted from the trailer park qualitatively different mm-hmm. than a black family evicted from the north side?
Did you have the same number of neighbors in both settings?
More or less. The trailer park was more enclosed as a neighborhood, and the rooming house spread out to much more neighborhoods.
You come into this trailer park, and it's obvious that you're a young professional talking to people who have poverty and other issues.
Right.
How long did it take for them to welcome you?
Well,
or did they have a problem welcoming you?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's a honeymoon period where it's kind of exotic and fun, but then that wears off after a while.
After how long?
It wore off after about a month and a half. And people kind of said, why are you still here? Why are you sticking around? But every case is different. There will be a subset of people that just won't talk to you no matter how hard you try.
Okay.
But you'll be surprised that you probably know this better than I do, but how many people will be open and honest about their lives if you take the time to listen and be honest.
If you have that trusting relationship.
Absolutely.
It is amazing some of the details that they give you. But go ahead. This is your story.
That's true. That's exactly true. So, it's not often that someone comes and takes a really deep, sincere interest in your life. And so even people that are going through something as violent and traumatic as eviction let me in, shared a lot of things, and I shared with them too. I shared my car, I shared my cell phone, resources sometimes.
Did you get money?
Sometimes, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, sometimes.
Now, what about the budget for this project?
Mm-hmm.
Was it underwritten with grants?
Mm-hmm. The MacArthur Foundation was the biggest... support of this research. National Science Foundation and HUD also funded it, as well as a number of other foundations. Most of that money went to a survey, which is called the Milwaukee Area Renter Study, or MARS,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
MARS.
And so that's a random sample survey of low-income tenants in Milwaukee that's wrapping up right now. We asked information about eviction, about housing problems, and about more broader things like civic engagement, relationship to the neighborhood, that kind of stuff. So we really survey what are some of the causes and main consequences of eviction on an aggregate level. I could tell you with the folks that I spent time with what those were in their lives,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to see if those findings kind of held statistically in a statistically meaningful way.
So you live in a trailer park for 4 months.
That's right.
And then how did you pick your north side neighborhood?
Well, one of the things that the trailer park landlord did when I was there is hired a security firm, and the security firm was made up of men from the north side of Milwaukee, and I got in with one of those guys, and I kind of hit it off, and I told him I wanted to move to the north side, and he said I should be his roommate, and that's the that's how it happened.
Is that what happened?
That's what happened.
In an African American
neighborhood? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this was one of the poorest and most segregated areas of the city.
And you
predominantly
were there
black.
Longer time? 8 months?
About 8 months, yeah.
Were you coming back to Madison and tests on the weekends?
Yeah, on the weekends once in a while. But the week, including holidays in Milwaukee.
So you were one of the few white faces in this neighborhood in Northside Milwaukee.
That's right.
Did that take a much longer time for them to accept who you were? Was there much more hostility?
Sometimes not. It's hard to speak generally about it. one thing that was one threat that was present on the north side that wasn't in the trailer park was the assumption that I was either an undercover policeman or worked for Child Protective Services. Those were the kind of the big assumptions about who I was.
Those are barriers in terms of those residents sharing their lives with you,
aren't
they?
Yeah, that's right.
How did you get beyond that?
Being persistent, being open and honest, showing them previous work that I'd done with my name on it, articles and books and that kind of stuff. And just taking a genuine interest in them. There's no secret to it. Everyone's very different. So some people were very open right away, and some it took a lot of effort. And some you think you're in with them, and you realize after several months that you're only beginning to get to know them.
I want to ask you about that. I once was at a conference with a Pulitzer Prize winner, Leon Dash, then mm-hmm. of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
He moved into a poor neighborhood in Washington, and here's mm-hmm. what he said about that. It took me months to figure out the people who I was interviewing were telling me what they thought I wanted to hear.
That's right.
Did you find that?
There was a part of... there definitely is a part of that, and there's a story that people like to tell about their lives. And this isn't just for people in low-income neighborhoods. We all do it. We all have rationales and stories about why you picked one thing and not the other. And you really have to spend time with people to kind of get to something that's close to the truth. I mean, what people say and the accounts that people give and the rememberings of the people have of it are often quite different than what actually happens and what actually happened. So, like any good journalist, I try to verify everything by different sources, by fact-checking, by drawing on, if there are administrative records of things, drawing on that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one family in the trailer park told me they absolutely were not evicted, they'd never been evicted. Okay, but then I looked them up in the eviction records and discovered they had. And the reason for that wasn't because they were lying to me or anything like that. They just didn't. They had a very narrow conception of what eviction was. What eviction was to them was the sheriff coming, knocking on your door, dragging you out by the arm, throwing all your stuff on the curb, changing the locks. That happens, but that's an extreme, the kind of whitetail tip of the eviction process, so to speak. There's a lot of evictions that occur. Before that.
So they had moved often, but in terms of their mind, they had not been evicted.
Right, that's exactly right. And so, you know, a little gumshoe work kind of clarifies things. Now, that insight is an important one. It shows you, if you have a survey like I did, and you ask people, have you ever been evicted? And people say no, a lot of times you have to ask other questions to kind of get to...
How long have you lived here? What was the circumstances?
Right. Have you ever been asked by a landlord to move?
Yes.
Did you get an eviction notice and move before you went to court?
Yes.
You know, just because you didn't go to court doesn't mean you weren't evicted. You know, so you really have to understand kind of the vernacular and the dominant modes of thought of people in certain neighborhoods to get it, kind of the accuracies of what's happening.
Were the issues of living in the North Side neighborhood the same as in the trailer park? Poverty, crime, drugs?
Right.
Same common denominators?
Yes and no. There's been a long tradition of sociology that says, you know, white poverty is very different than black poverty. We can't just say because you make X number of dollars and I make X number of dollars and you're African American, I'm white, that we have the same experience. It's not like that. So mm-hmm. one thing that's different is that the majority of poor whites in America don't live next to other poor whites. That is, their neighborhoods are more economically integrated.
Oh, distributed.
That's right. It's the opposite.
Income distribution.
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
It's the exact opposite for African Americans. So the majority of poor African Americans live in close vicinity to poor African Americans.
Yes.
So the last 30 years, we've seen a concentration and intensification of inner city black poverty. That in and of itself, that neighborhood level poverty has different effects than just individual. What's in some individual's level, individual's bank account, so to speak. So evictions are much higher in black neighborhoods than white neighborhoods, even very poor white neighborhoods. So the majority of the city's evictions occur in black neighborhoods, 63% of them.
Go ahead. My question was, do you think landlords are more often letting white renters skate than African-American renters?
With respect to the eviction decision?
Yes.
That's a hard question to answer.
Okay.
I don't have an answer.
Probably
to that
a not
yet.
Fair question. Sorry.
No, no. No, that's a, it's very fair. The survey will tell us.
Okay.
But I don't know yet. One thing that is, one dimension that's different is that men and women typically, this is very typically, and the story is much more complicated than that, but typically men and women tend to react to eviction notices differently. And this gets back to your question, but it needs a little prelude. When women get an eviction notice, the majority of them respond by approaching the state or family members for help. And they kind of avoid the landlord, the majority of whom are men, okay. and the majority of whom can be kind of a gruff bunch.
Right.
Not all of them, but you know, a good amount of them. Men, on the other hand, typically approach a landlord directly, and they offer to do something, offer to what's called working off the rent. Look, I know I'm behind, but what can I do? Can I patch a roof? Can I lay concrete? Can I paint units? I never once witnessed a woman approach a landlord with a similar offer. There's a okay. sad exception, which is when female tenants trade sex for rent. Now, in white communities...
Was that isolated?
What do you mean by
trading
isolated?
Sex for...
Was that an isolated...
Rare?
It's hard to know, but I've heard it more than once.
Okay. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, in white communities, many times men and women are on a lease at similar ratios. In the black community, however, women are predominantly the leaseholder. The reason is because the expansion of the criminal justice system in low-income African-American communities, a lot of African-American men have contact with the criminal justice system. They have a mark on the record, so to speak. Unemployment, black unemployment, is pandemic in low-income black neighborhoods. So in Milwaukee, less than half of working-age men, black men, are out of work. So you have black men who can't get a lease, because they're either unemployed or have a mark at extremely high rates. So this is kind of disproportionately the women who are on the lease.
Right.
So the women are disproportionately the leaseholder. They're going to be disproportionately the person that approaches a landlord when the eviction notice comes, and they're going to be disproportionately the one who reacts in a way that's less favorable or less successful at staying on eviction than the way men typically do. And so this is one difference, but this is complicated, but it's one difference between a poor white and a poor black neighborhood, the kind of the gender dynamics of how that relates to the eviction decision.
And didn't your study also find that black women, because of some of these factors, more willing, well, that's a wrong term, they put up more with domestic abuse to not be evicted? There was a domestic abuse
right.
part of your study, wasn't
right.
there?
Right. So this... this needs a little context.
Okay, please.
The context is, in 2001, Milwaukee enacted a nuisance ordinance. This is how it works. If you're a landlord and police get called to your address three or more times in a single month for a nuisance or a set of nuisances, then you get a letter. It says, Dear Steve, your property at so-and-so address has been deemed a nuisance. Nuisance property because this, this, and this. And it lists the police calls and lists the activities. What are you going to do about it? And so you have to respond within 10 days, I believe.
The burden is on me as the landlord
Absolutely.
To respond.
It's kind of an outsourcing, so to speak, of police work to you. You have to respond to the city saying, to the police department, saying, I've got your letter. This is how I'm going to abate the nuisance. The police approves your plan of attack or disapproves it. And you have an X number of days to abate the nuisance under threat of fines, serious fines, between $1,000 and $5,000.
Wow.
It's a really bad day when you get a letter, okay?
Yeah.
Now, this nuisance ordinance is not unique to Milwaukee. Chicago has it, L.A. has it, Fort Collins has it, Madison just renewed one. And so this is the kind of nationwide, there's these nuisances. And policymakers touted these as drug abatement things. Mm-hmm. We want landlords to get drugs and blight out of their properties. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can charge landlords for not ignoring their properties, ignoring problems in the properties, we can decrease crime. But the landlords who I hung out with said, you know what, these nuisance properties, you know what we always get nailed for is domestic violence. They said, I'm getting cited for domestic violence. So to verify this, I called Milwaukee Police Department. I asked for the letters, the nuisance letters that they send out. And they agreed to give me the letters for Police District 4, which is a pretty big district in Milwaukee. It's one of seven. And I simply counted and tallied the nuisance ordinances.
I see.
The nuisances, okay?
Yes.
And so there's about 700. They gave me a sample of about a year and a half. There's about 700 nuisances. Of those 700, over 200 were for domestic violence. So it's
single biggest category, certainly.
Single biggest category. It's not just a popular, it's the most popular nuisance. Drugs were 21. And so what you have is a policy. It's not an unintended consequence of a policy. It's a policy that just is affecting the wrong people. Okay? It's not crashing down on drug dealers. It's crashing down on battered women. So the question is, how do landlords abate the nuisance of domestic violence?
Yes.
They evict. If the nuisance is noise, you can hang up a please be quiet after 9 o'clock sign. If the nuisance is loitering, you can do the same. If the nuisance is an aggressive dog, you can make your tenant get rid of the dog. You can't hang up a sign that says don't hit your spouse, don't hit your girlfriend. Okay. And so the most effective way that landlords deal with the nuisance is eviction. So you have women in domestic violence relationships that have to choose between either calling the police on their abusers and risk getting evicted, or staying in their apartments and risk more abuse. Now, how does this disproportionately affect black women? We have more police presence in black communities. And so you have more police, you have more likely to hear a domestic dispute, have a neighbor call you over, say, you know, they're fighting right now, this kind of thing. If you have more police in this neighborhood, you're going to have more documented nuisance activities.
Tell me, your study is going to be published when? Your doctoral dissertation?
Oh, I don't know.
Soon,
yeah.
But
I just had a baby. You know.
Yeah, that's right. Congratulations on
Thank
the baby.
You.
But what national debate should your research foster?
Sure. So let's start with the local. You know, with respect to the nuisance ordinance, one can make a case that this is a clear violation of the Fair Housing Act. You have a policy that, in theory, is fair and didn't want to have this effect at all. But in practice, you have it disproportionately affecting women,
yes.
Especially women in abusive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Something needs to change. You know, and one thing is that a policy like this, a nuisance ordinance policy, needs to be monitored rigorously. You know, it shouldn't be the case that a sociologist discovers this by accident, as it were.
That's true.
You know, the city needs to be closely monitoring which activities are being documented more, where they're taking place, and is this the kind of nuisances that we really wanted to abate with this policy, number one. Number two, we can either remove domestic violence from the list of nuisances, or we can somehow give sensitivity to the police officers that are dealing with this about how to document this, or we can have some sort of escape clause, as it were, in the law about domestic violence as a nuisance. You know, this is kind of a straightforward fix to an unanticipated consequence of a policy. Number one. Broader is that we need to start putting housing back on the national agenda.
Okay.
You know, for the past 30, 40 years, it's slid off the national agenda. And with respect to poverty debates, we've spent more time on things that arguably aren't as important as housing. School lunch, free school lunches, for example. Vaccines. These are important, of course, but housing is a fifth of the national economy. It's everyone's most expensive
expense.
We need to start really getting serious about this. And what this study shows is that we've reached an unreasonable point in urban America today, where the cost of living and the incomes of the poor are touching. So, just one example. In 1997, the HUD fair market rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Milwaukee was about $460.
97?
Okay. In 2008, that number is $660. So it's jumped about almost 40%. It's more than a 40% increase.
Yes.
The cost, the welfare stipend between those years, over those 10 years, has not increased at all.
Zero.
It was $673 in 97. It is $673 today. Minimum wage has increased a few times, but it's still not enough. And so we have the incomes of the poor being far outpaced by historic cost of housing. So something has to give. What exactly and what with what consequences? is a question that policymakers and social scientists need to pursue with commitment.
Now that you have done what everybody regards as a landmark study of evictions, once you finish it, has this inspired you to do eviction 2, version 2.0, or what's your next professional study?
That's a great question. I'm going to keep those ideas closer to the vest.
Keep them, okay.
The Mars survey has a treasure trove of data that still have yet to be analyzed.
I see.
And so there's a lot of things to learn from that study, and we're working to get sponsors to expand it and making it not just about renters and eviction, but more about housing in general in low-income neighborhoods.
Okay. So you have had quite a ride with this study, haven't you? You found data that you didn't think was out there. You've got national acclaim, New York Times, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, NPR. How's it feel?
I hope I have it right.
Okay.
You know, I feel that this is an extremely important issue. It's important to the families that I met and who invited me into their lives in Milwaukee. And it's important to families every day. About 20 evictions happen every day in Milwaukee. 20 a day. And so this is an important issue, and it is important not only for families that are going through this, but also for Americans as a whole. I mean, there's a moral cost and a financial cost for regulating these problems to a certain sect of society that maybe we don't come in contact with each day.
And the biggest disparity, you're twice as likely to be evicted if you're black. A black woman.
If you're an African American woman
in Milwaukee,
if you're an African American renter woman in Milwaukee, the ratio of eviction is about 1 in 16. If you're a white woman, the ratio is about 1 in 56. If you're a white man, the ratio is about 1 in 100.
Oh my! Matt, congratulations! Congratulations on the research. It's very, very troubling research. It's going to launch your career. You're moving on to Harvard?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you going to take the chickens in the backyard of your house?
Oh, Cambridge has a chicken ordinance, but Boston doesn't. So if we end up in Cambridge, we might, in Boston, we might have to sneak them in the back door, so to speak.
Matt, good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your interest.
Sharing your research.
Thank you.
Our newsmaker guest today has been Matt Desmond. He's a Ford Foundation Fellow. He's a UW-Madison sociologist until July 1, when he will be going off to Harvard. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.